Mysteries above Paris and below Toronto. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's Tuesday, February 24th. Drones have been spotted flying above landmarks in Paris, but no one knows who's flying them or why.
I mean, this is somewhat ironic because France has been trumpeting its own homegrown companies that have invented these drones.
Meanwhile, police in Toronto have a mystery of their own under the city.
It's not so much the tunnel that has police so concerned. It's the fact that they don't know why it's there and who put it there and what the motive for this may be.
Plus, it's too darn hot to play soccer in Qatar in the summer. So what happens to the 2022 World Cup?
Surprise, surprise. They're going to move it to winter months, late November to late December.
The stories ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Muslims here, Christians there. Coming up on the program, an imam here in the U.S. describes a message ISIS extremists use to try to lure Muslim teenagers in America to join their cause.
We are it. We are the most pure. And we're here to stand for justice and for freedom. And they use attractive words.
That's later on The World. First, though, Christians in ISIS territory. That can be a deadly combination. Remember that video of ISIS-linked extremists in Libya beheading Egyptian Christians? Right now, it's Christians in Syria who are in the crosshairs of the so-called Islamic State. ISIS has raided several villages in northeast Syria and abducted as many as 90 Assyrian Christians there. The extremists have repeatedly gone after religious minorities in both Syria and Iraq, and this seems to be the latest example. Mardeen Isaac is in London with a Demand for Action. It's a group that monitors the ISIS threat against minorities. Here's his account of what happened in northeastern Syria.
Between 5 and 6 a.m., Islamic State militants staged an incursion into the Assyrian villages along the Khabur River, which is in northeast Syria between Hasaka and the Turkish border. It was a raid with a mixed purpose, the instigation of terror, which is a general principle of the group, of course, and also the abduction of hostages, which so far it appears are exclusively male. The women and children who could flee fled. A few of the men who had arms defended the village to allow them to flee. But in villages such as Tal Shamiram, for instance, the men of Tal Shamiram were taken to the Abdelaziz mountain, where they're now being held as hostages. And the Islamic State is demanding a prisoner exchange involving the release of their own captive militants being held by Kurdish forces.
The people who were targeted were Assyrians. Tell us who the Assyrians are. And why are they being targeted by ISIS extremists?
Who they are? They are an ethnic group indigenous to southeast Turkey, northern Iraq, northwest Iran, northeast Syria, that contiguous region. They have inhabited the Middle East since the origin of the Middle East. Their language is rooted in the great languages of the Fertile Crescent, Aramaic and Akkadian. And they're a distinct ethnicity in every sense of the word. Over the last 100 years plus, they've been the victims of the convulsions in the region involving redrawing of borders, ethnic cleansing. In the case of ISIS, their predecessors and groups who share their ideology have been persecuting, extorting, harassing, murdering, kidnapping Christians of all kinds in the Middle East since 2003 in Iraq and over the last 4 years in Syria. Now, in some cases, of course, they claim that it's because Christians are quote-unquote crusaders, or that they're loyal to certain regimes.
Well, there was one military observer who suggested that ISIS has had a string of losses, so they are waging attacks to secure new areas, a kind of sense of desperation. Do you agree with that?
No. I mean, it's too difficult to discern a general trend, I would say, in the military success or defeat of ISIS. And it's too easy to jump to conclusions that a certain momentum is gathering. They're an omnidirectional, their belligerence is omnidirectional, so they're potentially attacking on all fronts at all times, even though at certain points they might stage an incursion into an area and then withdraw like they did in the Nineveh Plains. Talk of even defeating ISIS as if that's, you can only defeat an enemy that accepts loss, that accepts defeat. ISIS will never accept defeat. So, I mean, they can certainly be weakened on some levels, but that would require a level of cooperation and coordination that doesn't exist in Iraq or Syria.
There is a video of raw footage of these captives being taken away in cages on the back of pickup trucks. I mean, the drama ISIS plays with is really creepy. Have you seen this video?
No, I don't. I don't watch videos that ISIS make.
You don't see a need to watch for your own research into ISIS?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
Why not?
Because I know what's in the videos, and to me, it's really just pornographic. I mean, I don't. It doesn't help me understand anything, and I know that they're meant to be watched. So I don't wish to endorse that purpose.
Understood. So, I mean, I know your group looks out for the well-being of these people, but I'm just wondering, do you have any position on if it comes to some kind of trade of hostages? What's your position on that?
My position is that it's a routine aspect of war, and of course Western states should negotiate for the release of the hostages. I mean, I refuse to accept that there's any legitimate reason for these innocent people to die in the appalling manner that so many other hostages of the Islamic State have died. So yes, I mean, I demand and I'm calling for as strong and as assertive action as possible to secure the release of the hostages.
Mardeen Isaac with the group A Demand for Action speaking with us from London. With all the horrific acts committed by ISIS, you'd expect hate, anger, and grief from the people whose communities have been victimized, like Coptic Christians in Egypt, who saw 21 of their own beheaded in that ISIS video from Libya. But listen to this. That's the voice of Egyptian singer Anne Alfred. In a video that's now gone viral, she asks for forgiveness, not hate. May Norman, my friend and colleague over at BBC Trending, spoke with Anne. May joins me now from London. What does Anne say in this video? Translate for us, May.
Anne's message in her video is about forgiving, especially your enemies. She says that forgiving and loving those who are around you and your family is easy, but forgiving those who persecute you and show you hate is actually much more difficult. And this is what she believes her religion teaches her. And she wanted to send this message not just to Christians, but to all Egyptians.
And does she explain what forgiveness does? I mean, we're caught in this kind of like seemingly nonstop cycle of revenge.
For her, she when I spoke to her, she said that, you know, it's only normal that people will feel hate and anger at the acts of the Islamic States and others towards Egyptians and the Egyptian Christians, especially. And she understands, for example, the families would actually, you know, it's completely normal that they would ask for revenge or be seeking revenge for what happened to their children. But what she hopes is that spreading love and forgiveness would be a stronger message than that of hate, because this cycle of hate needs to end somewhere. That's what she believes.
Mm. I mean, it's a great bumper sticker, but when you get down to the micro level, I mean, when you spoke with her, did she tell you how she'd convinced, for example, the mother of one of the men who was beheaded in Libya to forgive?
She recognizes that it's not necessarily realistic to go and ask the families to forgive. She realizes that it's a lot to ask and that it might happen and might not happen. But I guess her message is one of hope, that people can just let go of the hatred and move on. But interestingly enough, actually, this video, while it trended now, was actually, she made this video back in 2011, right after tensions were high between Christians and Muslims inside Egypt. Mm. But what we found, interestingly, is that the messages back then under the video, when it trended in 2011, there was more of a debate between Muslims and Christians about who's right and who's wrong and who started these tensions and who's to be blamed for what's happening and the sectarian violence that erupted in Egypt after the revolution. But now the messages under the video are mostly messages of support from both Muslims and Christians in Egypt. They're showing solidarity now that they've found a common enemy that hurts both of them.
And Alfred, how well known, how popular is she, a singer in Egypt?
She's a Christian singer, so she's quite popular amongst the Christian community in Egypt. And she's 27, she's quite young. She's a singer and a performer. She does several of these videos, and a lot of them are popular on social media in Egypt.
So the reaction prompted by this video was a reaction to what happened, this mass beheading in Libya. Could it possibly bring together Christians and Muslims in Egypt as a result?
Well, The relationship between Christians and Muslims in Egypt has always been one of tension. Even before the revolution, there were tensions, but they were kept under control to some extent. And now people are seeing a bit more reasoning and more unity. You can't really say that now that they're both completely in, you know, united. But now that they found or they feel that they're under the same threat, they feel that if they stand united, they're stronger that way.
Mein Oman, my colleague at BBC Trending, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And you can see that Egyptian video, Encouraging Forgiveness for Your Enemies, at PRI.org. I love playing soccer, but I'd no sooner go out on an icy sub-zero field to have a kick around right now in Boston than I would play in 110-degree heat. I say that because ever since soccer's governing body, FIFA, chose Qatar to host the 2022 World Cup, there have been complaints. Yep, about corruption in the selection process and horrible working conditions for the workers building new stadiums in Qatar. The world has covered both those stories. Today, though, complaints about the timing of the event. Traditionally, the World Cup is held in June and July, right? But these months are unbelievably hot in Qatar, with the highs averaging well over 100. So from the day FIFA selected Qatar to host in 2022, it was obvious to all that such conditions would be dangerous for players and for fans. All right, maybe not so obvious to FIFA, but today FIFA announced how it proposes to deal with this. And the world soccer expert William Troop is here to fill us in. What is FIFA going to do to address this problem, William?
Surprise, surprise. They're going to move it. They're going to move it to winter months, late November to late December. And they're probably going to make it a little shorter so that it doesn't last a full month.
But still in Qatar.
Still in Qatar. That doesn't change.
World temperatures, though, are no state secret. Why did it take FIFA so long to kind of come up with this plan to address the heat?
Well, I suspect that the answer depends on who you ask. But I believe that basically this is an excellent example of the very nebulous, smoke-filled room way that FIFA makes decisions. I suspect that the FIFA president, Sepp Blatter, had a plan for this all along, but he's just strung it out to make it seem like it's not his decision. And he put a task force in charge and let them make the decision, which really they didn't have that many options. Moving it to other parts of the year wasn't really feasible for a variety of reasons, including the fact that another possible month that they could schedule this World Cup, February, is already taken in 2022 by the Winter Olympics. So they really were hemmed in, and November, December seemed like the only viable option in the end.
So if this successfully gets through, if FIFA gets the World Cup pushed back by 5 months, won't that have a kind of a serious knock-on effect on all the professional leagues that would normally be playing in the fall?
Oh, absolutely. And they've been howling about this all along as this decision has been coming down the pike. And the head of the association of some of the top clubs in the world, which are in Europe, already made known that those clubs are going to demand financial compensation for FIFA for having to change their schedules that year. On the other hand, I'm not crying too much for them. I mean, these are clubs that make a lot of money from this. And, you know, they will make a lot of money if they play the month before or the month after. They'll be all right. And they have 7 years to prepare. So that part is not so much of a problem.
So aside from many players and fans not passing out in the heat if this is moved to November, are there any other upsides to this FIFA proposal?
Well, I actually do see one upside, and that is the fact that usually when the World Cup is played in June and July, the world's best soccer players have been playing since August and September the previous year, straight all the way to the World Cup in June and July of the next year. What that means is that by the time they get to the World Cup, they are completely exhausted. I mean, that's usually the time on another year when there is no World Cup when these players rest.
Right. They go to Saint-Tropez and hang
instead
out.
On a World Cup year, they have to go and do it again somewhere else. So in this new scenario for the 2022 World Cup, they actually will have to interrupt these professional leagues all around the world at the peak of the season. And these top players will be in peak physical shape to play the biggest tournament of their lives. So I'm actually kind of excited as a fan to see that.
Yeah, well, better action, better performance, better sports. That's a huge upside. The world soccer man, William Troop, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Soundproof walls, moisture-resistant light bulbs, a portable generator. Those are just some of the things the Canadian police have discovered in a mysterious underground tunnel. The 30-foot-long tunnel was found on the property of York University in Toronto last month, and police are still trying to figure out who dug it. The CBC's John Lancaster broke the story. Where exactly is the tunnel, John?
Marco, it's in a suburban part of the north end of Toronto. If I can paint the picture for you, there's a large tennis stadium, which is called the Rexall Center, where they have the ATP Tour. Just to the west of that is a large but narrow forest, and it's in that forest just to the west of this tennis stadium where police uncovered this tunnel. And like you say, it's not so much the tunnel that has police so concerned. It's the fact that they don't know why it's there and who put it there and what the motive for this may be.
What were police doing in the forest? Did they have a hunch that there was a tunnel and they went looking for it?
This was a fluke discovery, Marco. It was a conservation authority worker who was simply patrolling the forest looking for refuge and that kind of thing that he found a gas canister on top of a small pile of dirt and decided to take a closer look. He shoved away some of the dirt, and underneath that was a flat piece of wood that was covering a hole. Well, he pulled that off and looked down and saw a ladder leading down into this dark tunnel. Well, police were called. They went down into the tunnel and discovered this wasn't the work of children. This wasn't some kind of tunnel prank. This was highly sophisticated, as you said. The walls had been reinforced with heavy timber. The ceilings had been reinforced. There was also a sump pump and a hose connected to drain the water out of that. The lights, tools left behind. Police figure several people had spent months and months digging this. By the time police intercepted it, it was about 33 feet long, more than 6 feet tall, and about 3 feet wide.
Right. So the suspicion is that it was being dug in the kind of current age. It doesn't go back like 50, 100 years.
No. The tools that were used, the compressor, the generator, these weren't old-fashioned bits of equipment. These were all relatively new bits. And there was also evidence of food and beverages down there. And one of the oddest pieces that was found down there was some rosary beads and a poppy, Remembrance Day poppy, nailed into the side of this tunnel. Again, another mysterious twist in all of this.
Yeah, maybe some secret society. Who knows? Well, dear listeners, for the visuals, we've got photos of it all at PRI.org. John, you were at a media conference with the Toronto police this morning. What are they saying about this?
Well, they're reaching out. They have revealed that they've sent pictures of this tunnel to security agencies, including American security agencies, around the world in hopes that someone might recognize the style of build of this tunnel. Obviously, tunnels like this are far more common in the Middle East, Palestinian territories, and Egypt. They've been used to smuggle weapons and people. There's no suggestion that this is some kind of terrorist plot. However, police aren't taking any chances because that tennis stadium I was telling you a few minutes ago about, Marco, is going to be a host venue for the Pan Am Games this summer here in Toronto. It holds about 13,000 people. You'll have some of the biggest names in tennis, including American players, there this summer. So given the current state of the world, given these Pan Am Games are coming up, and that's why they've alerted security agencies around the world to see if anyone can assist them. So far, no luck. In fact, even a short time ago, perhaps a sign of just how concerned or even desperate police have become, a high-ranking member of the police service in Toronto tweeted, "Hey, if you built this tunnel, would you mind giving us a call?" They really don't have much to go on, Marco.
The CBC's John Lancaster in Toronto with the mystery of the tunnel discovered at York University. Let's just hope it's a bunch of people trying to get into a tennis tournament for free, John. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Paris woke up to its own mystery today. At least five drones, the type you can buy at a store, were spotted flying above Paris landmarks like the Eiffel Tower. The city is still in shock over the Charlie Hebdo attacks last month, and Paris is taking this quite seriously. That's a word from Vivian Walt, Time magazine's correspondent in Paris.
When you have something like nighttime flights of unexplained drones over the heart of the capital, it certainly might be designed to rattle the nerves of the security forces.
How did the security forces respond to these drones? Did they kind of take them out of the sky?
No. Well, the problem is that there really is no way to take them out of the sky. And in fact, the government has put out a bid for various research and high-tech companies to design a system that would intervene and take down unmanned objects of this kind. I mean, this is somewhat ironic because France has been trumpeting its own homegrown companies that have invented these drones. I mean, one of the most popular commercial drones at the moment on the market is something called the Parrot. That is a French-made product. It's a Paris company. The government has been very proud of it, and it's been selling like crazy in high-tech stores around Paris for about 500 euros. You can pick yourself up a drone and fly it off your terrace, if you like, and get very high-quality photos and videos of Paris at any time of the day or night.
What are the rules on flying drones in the city of Paris? Is it permitted?
Well, I was most surprised to find myself that you were not allowed to fly over central Paris below 19,000 feet. This is something that I certainly didn't know, and I'm sure many Parisians don't know. And I'm not sure that the law has ever been written for these devices in mind. It far predates anything like the invention of hobbyist drones, which are only a few years old, really.
So you can't fly a drone under 19,000 feet in the center of Paris, or is that a plane?
Well, one needs authorization, and it's unclear where you would need authorization from. But, you know, these are devices that are basically given out like as door prizes at high-tech conferences around Paris. These are things which have become a popular Christmas gift, and I don't think it would occur to regular Parisians that there's anything illegal about using one.
Yeah, it sounds like the law is still evolving on drones in Paris like it is everywhere else. Does anyone, Vivian, just go to a park in Paris anymore and fly a kite?
Believe it or not, there are still people doing that. Although I have to say that these drones are very, very popular in Paris. I don't know how popular they are in the US, but certainly around France, they've become extremely popular. And I think there's been something just very tantalizing about flying your own drone, about getting aerial photos. After all, you know, Paris images from the sky are very, very common. They're common on every single tourist website. And they've also become very, very common on things like big demonstrations, you know, marches through the city. You will see aerial footage. Often they're taken by these very lightweight drones that are operated from some kind of smartphone or iPad.
Yeah, well, one thing you can say about an aerial photo of Paris, it's always going to be pretty. Time Magazine's Vivian Walt speaking with us from Paris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman. Remember the Datsun 240Z?
It was a sports car, real muscular and cool-looking car, but it was affordable. A regular person could save up and enjoy a real sports car.
It also made Datsun a household name here in America. We remember the man behind the success of the Z car, ahead on the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with support from Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. You can learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We all know being an adolescent is not easy. You don't quite know who you are or where you fit in, and you're dreaming big. Now, imagine you're a Muslim American teenager, and something you've said online has caught the eye of a recruiter for an extremist group.
They will not leave him alone. They keep telling him, come with us, you become a hero, you've been created for a greater mission than just living in America and a comfortable life. We are your family.
That's Imam Mohammed Majid. He is the spiritual leader of the All Dulles Area Muslim Society in Northern Virginia. He says he's counseled several local young people who've struggled to resist the pull of violent jihad. Imam Majid told me that online recruiters know just what to say to play on the vulnerabilities of youth.
They try to tell them that they are more legitimate religious authority and they are the one who are the purest, and everyone is corrupted. The Muslim community, or the word, use the word ummah, which is an Arabic word for nation or community, are being humiliated, and we are here to uplift it, and we are here to bring, restore justice from all the injustice that we see around the world happen to the Muslims.
So tell me the story of just one person that you've met and how they were enticed by ISIS.
Most of those young people were not coming to the mosque. They are seeking learning Islam in a virtual space. Mm. And when that happened, those people monitor traffic of young people online and then immediately contact those young people.
How do these young people in the Washington area find out about what you're doing? I mean, how do you meet them?
Parents, when their child start talking this kind of ideas, they bring them to say, listen, there's a model here. Why don't you follow this? Why don't you listen to Imam Majid, for example? Before they bring them to us for remedy, to help them to change their mind and to rethink their position.
Imam, let's remember what young people are like, what adolescents are like, not terribly prone to following their parents' advice. So are you able to engage with them in any constructive way when their parents have brought them there?
Yes, because the argument of ISIS is some of it ideological. We want to tell the young people, and I do tell them, by using the Holy Quran and the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, why this is not acceptable. And this group of people are being known in Islamic history as Kharijites, people who rebel against the establishment but also have distorted idea of Islam.
Yeah, but for a lot of these young people, I mean, there's one young man who was quoted in a recent New York Times article about your work, and he said that when he was attracted to ISIS, it was because, quote, they once looked like eye candy to me. What is that attraction? What feels like eye candy to these young potential recruits?
It is, we are more authentic. Everyone is corrupted. We're the true Islam. The world is against us. We are here to restore the dignity and honor. We're here to correct the wrong of Muslims in Palestine. That's what he kind of is talking about. And now, and also they're saying, we're the true followers of Islam. We practice Islam more than anyone else. Other people have impurity to the practice of Islam, and we are it. We are the most pure, and we're here to stand for justice and for freedom and those kind of things. They use attractive words.
Since the rise of ISIS, have the members of your mosque felt less acceptance in American society? How's that changed how they feel as Muslims?
Our community here is very engaged and integrated in the larger community. But I would like to say that the young people are feeling sometimes the heat in public school, because every time ISIS posts a video where they're beheading someone, that impacts the community. And now we see the debate, the discourse in America. Some people said Islam is a problem. That is really troubling to me. And I think that's a change of discourse that I'm really worried about. All of us, we know the theology of the ISIS and others is the theology of death. And Islam teaches the theology of life. It's opposite of what Islam teaches and what Islam stands for.
Imam Muhammad Majid, the leader at the All Dulles Area Muslim Society, thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
If efforts to change the minds of young would-be ISIS recruits do fail, there's always stopping them en route. That's not easy, though. This week, police in the UK pulled out all the stops to try and find three British Muslim girls believed to be headed for Syria, but they were too late. Today, police said the three girls have probably already crossed from Turkey into Syria. You'd think that at this point, the authorities in Turkey and elsewhere would have made it harder to cross over to the Syrian front lines. But that's not necessarily the case, according to Joe Parkinson. He's the Wall Street Journal's bureau chief in Istanbul.
It's getting harder, but it's perhaps still not hard enough. What's happened over the past few months is that Western intelligence organizations have increased their cooperation, and they've particularly increased their cooperation with Turkey. And at Turkish airports, which were the favored routes for jihadists, security has been dramatically tightened. Turkey is still the main route, but for anybody who feels that they're a suspect, anybody who may be on some kind of blacklist, these people are starting to get clever. They're starting to take much more creative routes to try to circumvent this new security dragnet. One of these routes is by bus across European Union territory to the much less fortified Bulgarian border. Another route is flying into southern Cyprus, Nicosia, with a European Union passport, nipping over the dividing line. It's not actually a border there, an internationally recognized border, and then hopping on a ferry again to Turkish territory, at which point it's still relatively easy, if you have the contacts, to slip into Syria.
Now, I know you followed one recruit in particular, the wife, Miss Boumediene of Amedi Coulibaly. He was one of the Paris attackers. We recall the pictures of her at security at some airport on her way to presumably ISIS territory. I don't know if that narrative is accurate, but how did she slip through the net?
That narrative is accurate to a degree, and she used what's known in the security game as broken travel. So rather than flying directly from Paris to Istanbul in this case, she with an accomplice actually drove in a car to Madrid. In Madrid, they then boarded a flight to Istanbul's second airport. Normally, it's not the favored airports for people flying in from elsewhere in Europe. Her name was not passed to the Turkish authorities, and therefore, when her passport was run in Turkey, no flashing light, you know, popped up. The Turkish authorities still actually followed her for several days in Istanbul before, you know, concluding that she wasn't doing anything super suspicious, at which point she actually flew to the south of Turkey, slipped into Syria over a border area. And if we're to believe ISIS's monthly magazine, which I'm not sure that we can, but they claim to have had an interview with her inside Syria. No pictures, but they published an interview with her calling on other jihadis sympathetic from Europe to follow the path that she took.
Now, you spoke about the cooperation between European countries and Turkey, and yet it seems they're all playing catch-up and trying to stop these recruits from getting to ISIS. What's the problem?
It does seem like they're playing catch-up, and European governments now, just over the past couple of weeks, have held several high-level meetings, especially after what happened in Paris and then in Copenhagen, where they're trying to, I guess, break old habits and coordinate more. Intelligence agencies in countries with more resources and great counterterrorism operations like France previously were loath to share all of their information with poorer countries like Bulgaria, perhaps partly because they feared that it would leak, perhaps just because they jealously wanted to guard their own intelligence to make sure that they were the ones who could act on it. Now, that old system is obviously not fit for purpose given the new threat that's evolving, but they do still face a very, very difficult campaign to try and stop lone wolves who are using their European Union passports to move around the block. And of course, we shouldn't forget that amidst all of this, perhaps a bigger concern, although they wouldn't put it this way, is that these people come back. Mm. They come back trained, they come back with capability and perhaps even the idea and the logistics to carry out attacks in European cities. And 4 years into the Syrian conflict now, that's the big concern in the minds of these intelligence officials as they're trying to plan going forward.
Joe Parkinson, Istanbul Bureau Chief for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Late last year on The World, I told you about one of my favorite music releases of 2014, Dawn by Emma Donovan and the Putbacks. Emma is an indigenous singer from the north coast of Australia, and the Putbacks are a Melbourne-based band she teamed up with. Pop in their CD, and here's what you get.
Shut your mouth, keep on giving, till you just can't give. Getting weaker by the night, can't find a reason, no reason to live. Where he's good with his bad, where he's good with his bad, but you know it's not even.
Now, as I mentioned, Emma Donovan is an indigenous or aboriginal singer. She comes from a musical family, and her first gigs were with her mother and five uncles. These days, the 33-year-old has a bigger musical family. On first listen, Emma Donovan sounds like a lifelong devotee of funk and R&B. But when I spoke with her, I discovered a musical depth beneath that funky surface.
I was influenced a lot by Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette. My mum was a huge country music fan, so she had a big collection of American country music. And she'd teach me songs like Stand By Your Man. So country music was like a really probably one of the biggest influences.
And then on your father's side, your own dad had, I gather, a lot of blues albums, like old school vinyl.
Yeah, he was into a lot of old blues stuff. And he had what we call blackfella music here, which is Aboriginal music. And
blackfella music, that's what it's called?
Where we call it blackfella music.
And that refers to any kind of music produced in Australia by people of colour?
Well, today we kind of say Indigenous music, but, you know, us ourselves, we're comfortable with calling each other blackfellas. And so the other term that gets thrown around is blackfella music, which is what I like to say for other Indigenous, yeah, singers and songwriters.
I got to say, I am humbled by how little I know about Australia's pop music. I ask you all these questions, Emma Donovan, about your influences because the first track on your album called Dawn gives one the sense that we're about to meet Australia's version of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. But then the following tunes are really nuanced.
Pick up your lid, take a lift up, keep your head up, feel the love. Take a lift from me.
When you've got critics saying that you have come out with an album that is a gritty, uniquely Australian record, I mean, aside from the fact that you are Australian, what makes this music Australian?
I know there's different influences from Australia. We've been influenced a lot by American music. And I think the thing that makes it more Australian with this album is just the collaboration alone. Me being with Melbourne musos like the Putbacks. So I think the collaboration alone is very Australian. Me, an Aboriginal woman, meeting Melbourne's new funk kind of band.
A lot of American rhythm and blues and soul has, as you know, over the years been the mouthpiece for the civil rights movement. I'm just curious, what's the role, as you call it, blackfella music has played in Australia for people of color, Indigenous, Aboriginal people like you?
We've had some really strong influences over the years. When I first met the Black Arm Band, we did this gig called the Songs of Freedom, Murrinduck Songs of Freedom, and they were protest songs from, you know, from the times that our mob was fighting for land rights and fighting for all our mob. Some of the old songs are still very powerful. They talk about the injustice of our mob here. And it's pretty powerful. I feel like me as a younger person in this country, a younger Aboriginal artist, we've just had so many influences over the years, like Uncle Archie Roach, No Fixed Address, Yothi Indie Band, and even more recent, Gurumul. You know, Aboriginal music is, you know, in the country, it's getting a lot stronger. But we know that we've had a lot of influences, and we've had mob that have, like, made that path a little bit more clearer for us now, you know, to kind of come through and have that voice.
So I'm always curious, Emma, why people around the world turn to music to express themselves. Why do you sing? What does it give you?
Definitely, you know, happiness and calmness. Music is a good outlet, you know. I really feel blessed, I suppose, coming from the family that I have, that we have them kind of outlets for ourselves. You know, it's pretty amazing.
She is Emma Donovan. Her new album with the band The Putbacks is called Dawn. Emma Donovan, great to meet you. Thank you for the interview.
No worries. Thank you.
What do you got for me, Daddy? Ain't it plain to see?
If you want to capture the full vibe of this track, we've got the video from Emma Donovan and the Putbacks at PRI.org.
The sun's come out from the clouds. Ain't no rain on me. You ain't what I need. Set me free.
Coming up, a fast ride and a really slow ride on the world.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World, and for the remainder of the program today, let's talk transports of delight. Okay, maybe the second one isn't so delightful, but it is an important form of transport. You'll see what I mean in a few minutes. First, though, the democratically sexy Z-Car and the man who made it so. Yutaka Katayama turned the Datsun car brand into a household name here in the U.S. between the 50s and 70s, and a big part of that was the Z, an affordable and fun sports car for the everyday consumer. Mr. Katayama died last week at the age of 105. One person who followed his career closely is Yuri Kageyama with the Associated Press in Tokyo. In fact, she was one of the few invited to attend his funeral today.
It was a family gathering, and there were only a handful of people who were not family. But his son invited me because I did the obit on him for the Associated Press, and I have covered him. I felt it was only right that I go, and it was an honor to be part of that.
He had a rich life, a long life. Safe to say, he was not your typical automobile executive. Can you tell us who Yutaka Katayama was and how he ended up working for this post-war car company? It used to be called Datsun, now Nissan.
Yeah, so he was the person who Nissan sent to the United States to build the Datsun brand.
And this is
scratch.
Late 50s, early 60s?
Yes, yeah. They didn't even have like a real dealership or anything, and they were not known in the United States. That was when Made in Japan was not even reputed to have quality. So he had quite a challenge ahead of him, but he spoke English very well. He's very vivacious and full of life, and he's a very elegant person. He's in the U.S. Auto Hall of Fame, and he's also in the Japanese Automobile Hall of Fame. But the other Japanese who are in there, like Soichiro Honda, are people who are known for, you know, either having started the company or engineers. But Mr. Katayama was actually like a salesman. You know, he's the one that marketed the brand. He's not an engineer. So that's very unusual. But he was not like the kind of person who's just like trying to sell you something. Mm. He really believed in the product. And I think that's why he was so successful, was he had a way of communicating.
Yeah, and somehow was able to make
a sincere way, yeah.
Somehow was able to make Datsun a household name in this country in pretty short order.
Yeah, and key to that was the Z, the 240Z. It was a sports car, real muscular and cool looking car, but it was affordable. And he knew that that was going to be the next thing, was that people were going to really want a sports car that didn't cost too much. Another thing is that he's the one that said the car needed a better name than Fair Lady. That was what the name was in Japan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because in Japan, sometimes cars have very romantic names or they have almost feminine names. And so then he said, if you try to sell this car and you call it Fair Lady, Americans are not going to get it. So he's the one that proposed that it be a Z.
Where is the oddest place you ever saw a Z car? Like, for me, it's in context somewhere on the New Jersey Turnpike and going to a drive-in burger joint. What's the weirdest place you've ever seen a Z car?
Gee, I don't know. I mean, maybe I haven't been to enough odd places. There are huge Z car clubs, and that's international. Mm. They meet all the time.
And for them, is it the car, or do they know it's really all about Yutaka Katayama?
Oh, yeah, he gets invited to those gatherings, and he's like a hero for them. Of course, it is all about the car, but it's also about him, because he is known as the father of the Z.
His son apparently told you what he was perhaps fantasizing about when Yutaka ends up in heaven. What did he say?
Yeah, he did call me about his death before he told any other reporter. And he said that his father is happily zooming around in the Z in heaven, no longer having to worry about gas, police, or traffic tickets.
Yeah, no speed limit up there. Yuri Kageyama of the Associated Press, who has followed the career of the late Yutaka Katayama, dead at 105. Yuri, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And for the second part of our transports of delight, the final transport, the coffin. Okay, for some, it's increasingly an urn because, you know, coffins are just crazy expensive, averaging around $2,500. Yeah, death is expensive. No wonder some in the funeral supply chain are looking at less pricey options from China, like a 20-gauge steel unit for under $350. Yeah, but guess what? The Chinese-made caskets are not putting the American-made boxes out of business. Josh Slocum is the executive director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance, based in Vermont. Briefly, Josh, what is going on here?
Well, it's been incredibly difficult for entrepreneurs to break into the American funeral service market because the entire system is set up to be a very insular industry culturally and also with regard to technology. The only thing that a casket does is hold the body for a ceremony or transport it to the grave. They all do the same thing. So a lot of what we talk about, especially when you talk to people in the American funeral industry where they talk about, oh, those inferior caskets from overseas, a lot of this is a bunch of nonsense. The stories about the bottom is going to fall out and grandma will roll down the stairs. And yes, we do hear that story. It's funny now when we talk about it, but imagine the horror of a family who is looking to, you know, have a nice funeral, but do so economically to be told this by somebody in the funeral industry. And it has happened. It's quite horrifying. And the reality is there's nothing to that. The only people who can tell the difference, for example, between a 20-gauge thin metal casket and an 18 or 16-gauge heavy casket in the same color are the pallbearers and your pocketbook.
So how big a bite have Chinese caskets taken out of the made-in-the-USA casket business?
Well, I don't have statistics, but an educated guess would say probably very little.
And why is that?
Well, there's intensive industry resistance to change. And there's been everything from coordinated campaigns of disparagement about the quality to subtle but effective kind of discouragement. The consumer who is standing at the funeral home is not going to be the same person who is standing there before the car dealer. Most people have no earthly idea what's really true and what's false when it comes to funeral buying purchases, because the only people we get that information from is the gentleman who wants to sell it to us at the funeral home.
So let's get some news you can use to our listeners and consumers. Can you just buy a Chinese casket online and avoid the middleman?
You can buy a casket online, be it Chinese or Mexican. You absolutely can. You have the legal right to do so. Funeral homes have to accept the casket that you buy or even one that you make yourself. And yes, folks do.
Realistically and in the long run, is there a difference in how human remains hold up in the U.S. made boxes versus the Chinese made boxes? Or we all, in the long run, we all rot, right?
We all go back to the earth. I don't care whether you are cremated, whether you're buried in a sealed American casket or a non-sealed casket. There's no funeral product on earth that will make you any less dead. We tell people, remember, separate the love and the mourning and the grief and the good times, the memories, from the amount of money that you spend, because we're all going to the same place.
And he should know. He's Josh Slocum, Executive Director of the Funeral Consumers Alliance. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
And that's all from us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and we're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today, annenbergfoundation.org, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.